You'll have some fun on this edition of The Writer's Voice on the Virginia Voice. And for the Virginia Voice, I'm Lou Dean. With me is James Schmidt, M.D. Dr. Schmidt has been in the Richmond VA Hospital for 33 years. He's currently Chief of Internal Medicine. Not only is Dr. Schmidt praised for his medical expertise, but his colleagues call him the storyteller. And that's why he's here today. He's written a book entitled Speed Bumps and Tsetse Flies, a collection of stories and anecdotes about his adventures. Dr. Schmidt, I'm sure that people have heard that med school can be extremely stressful, and you give several methods of relieving stress in the book. Is storytelling and humor among those?
It certainly is, absolutely.
How did you get interested in first of all, medicine and then writing stories?
I'll be honest with you, okay? I actually had kind of a verbal part of my personality. When I was a young man, I got interested in astronomy. And that gave me a motivation. And I majored in astronomy at the University of California at Berkeley.
Perfect lead into medicine.
Right. How it led into medicine was one day it dawned on me that I had to make a living. And not that an astronomer can't make a living, but what I wanted to do in life would not lead me toward making a living in astronomy. So I panicked. And I said, what am I going to do? Well, I have all this science that I've taken, and I've got good grades in it. How can I apply that to a more practical job? I said, wait a second. Doctors make a living. Medicine is a science. I'll try to get into medical school. So without having ever been to a funeral or even worked with a doctor or anything, I tried to get into medical school and start taking courses. And wound up getting into medical school. I can tell you a little funny story about how having an eclectic major helped me get into medical school.
Please do.
When I was at the University of California at Berkeley, I majored in astronomy. I loved the stars and physics and all that goes with that. I minored in physical anthropology. I loved learning about fossils and human evolution and Neanderthal man and Pithecanthropus, and I knew that stuff. So I got to my interviews at the University of California at San Francisco. My first interviewer was a radiologist, a young man who just talked about astronomy. He was going to buy his kid a telescope. I talked to him about this, and we talked about the stars, and this man just loved me for no good reason except we had a nice interaction. I thought, I'm going to get in medical school. Wrong. My second interview was with a nasty old man who was like a neurosurgeon. He was down on me from the beginning. He asked me, why do you want to be a doctor? I said, to save lives. That's not why I wanted to be a doctor, but that sounded idealistic, and I was kind of a fraud. He figured out this out, and his comment to me was, well, if you want to save lives, become a highway engineer. More people die in traffic accidents than in medical problems. And I just fell apart. This man sees through me. So I had a horrible interview, and I was pretty sure I was not going to get into medical school here. I got up to leave this man's desk, and on his desk was a human skull. He looked up, and he said, yeah, we called him Sam. They had given this skull a name. And I ran my finger from the forehead onto the bridge of the nose. And I said, you mean Samantha? The neurosurgeon said, what? The old man said, what? I said, this is the skull of a female. He said, how do you know that? I said, because if you run your finger from the forehead of a male onto the bridge of the nose, you hit a bump. In a female, it's smooth. This is like you're skiing. If you hit, it's smooth. If you're skiing from the forehead of a man onto his nose, you hit a mogul. In a female, it's smooth. This is the skull of a female. This man suddenly was impressed with me and smiled. This is the first time he'd had any interest in me at all. And maybe I was saved by this, but I got into medical school there. So an eclectic knowledge maybe was useful in getting into medicine.
You are a doctor, and yet you tell wonderful stories. You're known for this, as a matter of fact, and you took the trouble to write them down, which is delightful. Tell us some of the stories, because that's what makes your book, Speed Bumps and Tsetse Flies, interesting.
Okay, I will tell you. I will start out with more books are, certainly they start out with me telling stories, and then it translated into a book. My wife, who reads books, commented, you have to write something down where when somebody is standing at a bookstall, they want it with the first page. So I wrote the first chapter. It's called A Date with Annie. And I'm on the floor of an abandoned building in a hospital, and a cop has it on top of a woman, and a cop has his gun drawn. Okay. He thinks he's witnessing an assault. What happened was I was moonlighting at this hospital, the Contra Costa County Hospital in California, and one day I was called at my work in San Francisco because I was moonlighting there on Sunday, and the administrator told me the Joint Commission, who inspects hospitals, is coming Monday, and we need to know that you prove that you can do CPR. So cardiopulmonary resuscitation. So I said, okay, when you come to work Sunday in the emergency room, get the key from the supervisor and run off a strip on Annie. So I got caught up about 11 o'clock. I got the key and I went to this little abandoned building, opened it up, and there was a trunk there inside the building. And inside this trunk was Resus Annie, which is a cardiopulmonary resuscitation dummy. I started compressing her chest to get practice. This dummy, you had a key, you turned it, and paper came out of the chest. And when you compressed the chest, the pen made a mark on it, so you could prove that you knew this right. Just then, this cop walked in the dark. It was kind of a darkened room, and he thought he was witnessing an assault. So he drew his firearm, and it scared the heck out of me. He said, "What are you doing to that woman?" Finally, the fact that the dummy had paper coming out of her chest, which was balling up on the floor, convinced him this was not a woman, a real woman, and he shouldered his gun and he walked out the door. So that is how that story started.
You've had a number of close shaves.
Yeah, that's part of these quirky little things that happen. And I think one of the things that happened in my life, my parents were simple people. I did not quite learn all the fineries of getting along through life until later in life. So getting through these episodes may give me a little more of a quirkier life than the average person. Another chapter, which I like, was when I tried to get into medical school, I started taking biology courses at the University of California. I switched from physics and astronomy to medicine very quickly and tried to define myself suddenly as a good medical student, which was hard. Okay. Pre-med courses are very difficult, and there's a high curve. So I had trouble getting above a B in these courses because the competition was so great. So I decided I'll take this in summer school. My assessment, I figured people who take a course in summer school are not quite as smart as the people who take it during the regular time. So, and my assessment of how hard a course was going to be is how many people were wearing glasses in the class and how many people were Asians. Asians were hardworking. And I said, well, I'll take it in summer. When I walked into the first class in summer school, which was vertebrate zoology, the zoology of animals that have vertebrae, my heart sunk. Everyone in the room was an Asian person wearing glasses. So I said, this is going to be a hard class. Except one person was not. This was a heavyset woman, about 50, who was wearing a velvet dress, who looked like she was, and jewelry, who looked like she was going to the opera. Her name was Henrietta Gump. That was her name. That was her real name. And something about her told me that this is the one person in the class that I'm smarter than. So I bonded with her. And what had happened with her is she had been a nursing student 30 years earlier, dropped out of nursing school, and married a famous orthopedist. And she had lots of money and jewelry and a big house and everything. But she did not have a bachelor's degree. And she was the only one in her bridge club that did not have a bachelor's degree. So she was coming back to finish the courses. So I'd go over to her house and we would study. At night, she rented an apartment near the university during the week, and we would study. And by me trying to drive the material into her, I learned it. I learned from teaching. Well, Mrs. Gump had particular difficulty with the laboratory. We had a lab. We would dissect an animal, and we didn't use gloves in those days. And she couldn't stand to touch a dead animal. So she would come to the laboratory wearing a velvet dress with jewelry like she's going to the opera. Then I have to put her hands in a dead animal. Well, one day we were dissecting the brain of the shark. And her lab table was kitty corner from mine. And all day she was frantic. I could see her face was red. She's tearing into this animal and Something is horribly wrong. So finally, toward the end of the morning, I walked over to her and I said, Mrs. Gump, you seem to be having trouble. And then I looked and she was tearing away at the tail end of the shark, toward the bladder. And I said, the lesson today is about the brain. You know, how come you're digging away at the tail end of the shark or the bladder? She says, well, this is what it says in the lab manual. So she showed me her lab manual. These are put together by the University of California Press. They're loose leaf, you know, ring binder type things. The bottom of the page, the olfactory nerve, which is the smell nerve, goes from the brain, top of the next page, to the urinary bladder. So she had been following what the lab manual said all day. And then I looked at this. The bottom of page, this page was 186. The next page was 243. Of all the people in the class, she was the one that got the lab manual that had the extra page put in by mistake. This is put together by the University of California Press. So she had spent all morning trying to trace a nerve from a shark's brain to its bladder. So when I told her what had happened, she got philosophical and said, well, I thought it was a hell of a long nerve. That was her comment. When I got through the class, I thought I deserved a B+. I was trying to get an A in this class. But I went to the teaching assistant who was a man. His name is Mr. Rako. He had he was a heavyset man. He had kind of a thick neck, short neck. He reminded me of the character Peter Lorre, who was in the movies. And I asked Mr. Rako how I did. Mr. Rako gave me an A-. And I believe he gave me an A- because he knew I was helping Mrs. Gump. And so I said, Mr. Rako, I don't want to be too nosy, but how did Mrs. Gump do? He sighed, and then he spoke, and he said, I passed her. He said, I gave her a C-. I don't want to go through that again next year. So that was the story of Mrs. Gump. So, and that is actually my wife's favorite story in this book, the story about Mrs. Gump.
You've had some remarkable anecdotes. Tell us some from med school.
Okay.
I think that would be illuminating to our listeners.
Med school. Okay, there are stories about med school. There certainly are. When a student sees a patient, it is awkward. Sometimes. He's a medical student. Okay, like a second-year student. First-year medical school is pretty much learning anatomy and dissecting and biochemistry. But then the second-year medical school, you start seeing patients. And one of my colleagues had to do a physical exam on a patient. Okay. And the patient knew that he was a medical student. This was a cantankerous old man who smoked and he had COPD. And the student, my friend Ralph, I'll call him Ralph, the patient kicked him out of the room. He said, I don't want any GD medical students around me. So Ralph was devastated because the patient wouldn't let him examine him. So Ralph went to Professor Brooks, who was this older doctor who'd been around a long time, had white hair, and he told him, Ralph was crying. He said, that patient, Mr. Jones, won't let me examine him. Professor Jones said, don't worry, I'll show you how we do this. So Professor Jones, the older man, walked in the room with Ralph, and Professor Brooks walked in and said to Mr. Jones, I want to congratulate you. This is the University of California School of Medicine. This is one of the finest medical schools in the world. You know why it's so good? The patient said, no, because we have students. Everyone here is trying to learn how to do medicine better. We have students who are so good they've got the Nobel Prize. We're constantly learning how to do good medicine. This young man is a student, and I am a student. We're all students trying to take care of you. So would you consent to let a student examine you? The patient thought, and he says, okay, I will let a student examine me. But he looked at the professor. He said, I want one of those fat, white-haired students. Okay, so that was his way of saying, I'll take a professor who is a student too, but not a kid. So things that happened in medical school were not, it's kind of a scary thing, and I can tell you things that were done. Halloween one day, a long time ago, we were doing gross anatomy, and you go up to the top floor of the hospital, and in San Francisco it was very foggy and kind of scary anyway. Christian Bernard had just done the first human heart transplant in Africa, South Africa. So two students in the room duplicated Christian Barnard's transplant. One, you have a room full of cadavers. Every person gave their cadaver a name. Ours was a little old lady. We called her Mrs. Vanderbilt. We imagined she was an old lady who had donated her body. And one day, one student picked up a heart from his cadaver. But this is a heart transplant. He said, "Ready, Christian." And across the room was another student who was pretending to be Christian Bernard. The ready. He flung the heart all the way across the room. The other student caught it and plunked it into the chest cavity of his cadaver. So medical student, I think what happens to medical students is they suddenly, they're young people, and they suddenly make contact with the fact that they have their own mortality. So to compensate for that, they try antics and humor and sometimes things that are not as good.
Well, I would imagine, Dr. Schmidt, that there's just a lot of stress.
Right.
And there are, as I said at the very beginning, ways of relieving that stress. Humor is one of them.
Right, correct. Absolutely. We can move along a little further to there was in my residency, you move from medical student to school to residency, and as we've said, residency in those days was a very stressful thing. You worked 32, 36 hours straight sometimes. You started in the morning. You saw all patients that came on your team, which is a team of a resident and two interns, for 24 hours, and you never slept. And then you stayed around all day taking care of these patients, and sometimes till 10 o'clock at night, so you really are sleep-deprived. And to this day, sleep is a huge event in my life. When I hit Friday afternoon, I say, I can sleep all day tomorrow. Okay. But as I've said, the relief of the stress was these sweet-smelling angels of mercy called nurses. Okay. Nurses had 8-hour shifts. They were fresh. And there was a lot of bonding. Like I described in my book, an intern doing a lumbar puncture on a patient in the middle of the night, and the intern's very tired, and the nurse is helping him, and the intern luckily gets the needle right in the spinal fluid like he wants it, and clear fluid comes out, which is a good sign. That's called a champagne tap. It means that the fluid is not infected. And then the nurse goes behind and starts rubbing the back of the intern. She knows he's exhausted. So there's a lot of bonding, a lot of dating in that hospital. Sex was sort of the one thing that distracted people from all the stress. Well, I dated a nurse for a while. Her name was Candy. She was a tall, blonde woman. She was attractive. She had gold-rimmed glasses. She wore a tri-cornered nurse's cap. She called me Jimmy. And this is the San Francisco Bay Area in the 70s, okay? One day when she was going off, it's 5 o'clock at night, she's leaving, and I'm going to be there all night, she presented me with a pink box like you get in a bakery. She said, "I made you something." I opened the box, and it was a chocolate layer cake. I thought this was very domestic of her. I was surprised, so I said, "Thank you." Well, I didn't know what to do with this cake because I was going to be running around all night taking care of patients. Well, I took the cake into the intensive care unit. The intensive care unit nurses were my buddies. If ever I had a moment to close my eyes or lie down, I'd go in the ICU and lie down for 5 minutes. I never went to sleep, but just lying down on the bed, I figure if anything bad happens, it's going to happen in the ICU. So I gave the cake to the ICU nurses. About midnight, I walked into the ICU to see what was happening. And something funny, two nurses were sitting in front of the telemetry, watching the squiggly line of the EKG, laughing at it, and say, "Far effing out." Use the F word. Over there was another nurse laughing. There was a nurse lying on a hospital bed. Over here is a nurse vomiting. What is going on? What has happened? Candy had baked this cake chock full of marijuana pot. The nurses had all consumed it, and they were all stoned. This was a staffing nightmare. Not one nurse got sick, but all the nurses got sick. They had to call a supervisor. She had to call people at home to replace these nurses in the ICU. I thought this was going to be the end of my medical career. But by some miracle, it did not get to the higher-ups in the hospital. But the ICU nurses knew exactly what had happened, and one of them told me, I should get a new girlfriend the next day.
You're hearing from Dr. James Schmidt, who is Director of Internal Medicine at the McGuire Veterans Hospital here in Richmond. You're talking about med school, but you've been here in Richmond for some 33 years now, and you've had some adventures here.
Absolutely. I can tell you, I've been in Richmond. I'll give you a story. The story of the black man when I was I'm an endocrinologist. And when I got here a while ago, the new hospital, which is now a great big new hospital, which, by the way, is the second largest building in the state of Virginia. The only bigger building is the Pentagon. So our hospital is the second biggest building in the state of Virginia. That building was being built. The hospital consisted of some brick buildings. There where there's a lot of administration. There was a chapel on the corner, a little church, and actually we had grand rounds there where we'd have our medical lectures. At the speaker would stand at the pulpit, and all of the people would listen. Listeners would be down in the pews, and we would get lectures. It was army barracks. There were wooden buildings there. So one day I got called by the resident. He said, "Dr. Schmidt, I have a patient for you to see." So it's in one of the wooden bungalow buildings. And these buildings were like an army barracks. You'd see people smoking, playing cards, you know, all these things were very casual, loose. It's like an army barracks. He leads me in and he's describing a patient, the patient is called Mr. Finkelbaum. He said, "This man has high sodium level in his blood. Came in from a nursing home, old man with high sodium level in his blood. And the most common cause of a high sodium level in the blood is dehydration. You've lost so much water that the sodium goes up. But there are other causes." So we go into a little room next to the nurse's station where there's a blackboard, and we start talking about high sodium because I'm supposed to teach him something. And I'm going through the high sodium thing. And now he takes me into the ward to meet the patient. And we walk back on this ward, and it's a chaotic place with guys playing cards and smoking, and all these things are going on, you know. And it's like an army barracks, okay? And they're sitting in a wheelchair. This is black man. The resident says, "Mr. Finkelbaum, this is Dr. Schmidt." So I shook hands with the man. The man was very unresponsive, and he should have an IV in place. I thought because he was dehydrated, there's no IV. I was a little upset about this. And so then we walked back into the little room next to the nurse's station where the blackboard was. And after a couple of minutes, I said, "Wait a second. How does a black man get a name like Finkelbaum? That's a Jewish name, and here's this black man with a name Finkelbaum." So then we started thinking. Suddenly, the man's sodium became, we were worried about the sodium. I was worried about how he got his name. So we're sitting there going back and forth. I said, "Maybe in the unfortunate days of slavery in this country, there had been a plantation owned by a man named Finkelbaum, and sometimes the slaves took on the name of the owner. Maybe that is what happened. That's why this black man has named Finkelbaum." One other possibility, there had been some intermarriage back there, way been. A Jewish man had married a woman, and the Finkelbaum had gone down the male line, and that's why you have a black man with a name Finkelbaum. That was the third possibility was that the man had changed his name to Finkelbaum. But we're going back and forth on this mystery, you know, in this little room next to the nurse's station. The new resident comes in, a young man, call him a Dr. George, new resident, and I introduced myself. I said, "We're just wondering how a black man gets a name like this." Is a man the resident who knows the patient. I said, "How does a black man get a name like Finkelbaum?" Dr. George says, "Dr. Schmidt, Mr. Finkelbaum's not a black man." I said, "But his skin is dark. Then we have to work him up for diseases that make your skin dark, like too much iron or something." But I'm really puzzled. And the resident said, "Dr. Schmidt, Mr. Finkelbaum is not hyperpigmented." So he grabs me by the arm and he leads me under this ward. And the other resident follows. He made a mistake. What's happened? There's the black man sitting in the wheelchair again. Three beds over is a new patient who wasn't there before. He's a Jewish man with a yarmulke. Okay, he's got his IV in place. This man was an X-ray before. This is Mr. Finkelbaum, the new man with the IV. What had happened? The resident doing the consult had walked onto this big ward, asking for a patient, this chaotic ward, looking for Mr. Finkelbaum. He kept asking people, Mr. Finkelbaum, Mr. Finkelbaum. And the black man said yes. He said yes to everything. He was demented. So we had gotten the wrong patient. And that is how a black man got a name like Finkelbaum. So the moral of the story is, sir, is in medicine, it's important to make the right diagnosis. But before you can do that, you're going to make damn sure you have the right patient. And that's what happened there.
The book is Speed Bumps and CC Flies. There are far more anecdotes than Dr. Schmidt has been telling you. The book is available on Amazon. I think you'll enjoy it. We've been hearing from Dr. James Schmidt, who is in charge of internal medicine at the McGuire Veterans Hospital here in Richmond. You're listening to The Writer's Voice on The Virginia Voice. And for The Virginia Voice, I'm Lou Dean.